You're listening to The Morning Rush with Bill Carroll on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Graham Richardson from the CTV News at 6 is in for Leslie Roberts today. I've been listening to you a lot. You're really starting to get comfortable in this format. It's not bad enough you look great and you're great on TV and you're well-read. Don't take my format from me.
No.
Just, can you just do Never. One thing and do it well?
I
you
love
have fun,
radio.
Though, doing radio.
I love
I can tell.
Radio. It has been a I love this part of it, right? Like the space, the room, the conversation, and TV is very immediate. There's power of TV, the pictures, you know. Radio is and it's a fabulous opportunity to step in for Leslie for a little while here and there. So
it's great to roll up your sleeves and really dig into issues, isn't it?
It is.
You really have time and you know, you can have fun, but you can be serious. It's such a great emotional ride to be on too when you're hosting a show.
And I mean, look, internet, TV, they were all supposed to kill radio, right?
You can't kill radio. It won't die.
Nope, it won't die. And is more powerful now, I would argue, than ever. Because you're shareable platforms now. Like, your content is, you can blast it everywhere. And that hasn't hurt you either, because people are still in their cars. They're still listening in their cars. They're still listening, you know.
How'd you find that? Because I know you get a unique view of the city. You're on that bicycle so much. do you feel like Ottawa is back to normal or something like normal after opening up this weekend, or is it still strange? Because I haven't been downtown yet, but I will do this week. But is it odd, or does it feel like it used to?
Big step up on Friday.
Yeah.
Like physically, I could feel it in the city, partially because the sun was out. Yes, it was colder, but just that opening of something to go do, I felt a lot of people were walking around, and I literally was walking down William and people were sweeping out their storefronts. Like, it was like, you know, after the plague kind of a thing. And I know it's not over. It's not over. But there was a real sense of relief. I happen to, you know, Fiorella Salon does our haircuts, and she's opening for the public today. She had 250 bookings inside about 3 hours, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So she did the CTV people on Friday when she was allowed to open. There's a sense of relief there. So I went and get my hair cut. I come down. The patios are full. It looked like June in Ottawa, the Ottawa that I love. And so I think, Bill, there is a sense that we are going to get there. And I think there's still a bit of an ease that I understand. Like, what can I do? Where can I go? And my behavior is going to change. And then I think, just like anything, I think it's going to ease. Like, the day-to-day is going to ease. Like, I think people will get closer to back to what they were with extra caution. With extra caution. You know, wiping surfaces, washing hands, wearing
sure.
masks.
Sure. But you know what's odd about it is that psychologically, I think we've adjusted. Those first couple of weeks were really dark times, and they were scary. Although my kids have started to reminisce about them. Yeah. Do you remember how many movies we watched together, and we'd have snacks every night? Yeah. And yeah. Now they kind of miss it because we're not as intense about it, and everyone's kind of gotten – they're in different rooms now reading their own books. And there was a real sense of family, which was scary and cool at the same time. And then you kind of settled in. It becomes a new norm, especially if you have a job. I'm lucky to be able to do what I do from home, and – you're still coming into the studio. Our lives are unchanged more than some.
Yeah.
But then I went out to the restaurant on Friday night. I'm sitting on the patio. And it was kind of a stark reminder again of the fact that there's this scary virus out there, because it's something that's just not as relaxed about a waitress coming up to you with a full face shield on.
Yeah.
Like she's playing in the NHL or something. You know, the visor. It's just we're not quite there.
No, we're not. And we may not even, like, the mechanics of how a vaccine is going to be distributed, you know, like, until we get there, then we're going to be in somewhere here. But like, I've done a few things I've done some shopping, you know. Regular shopping for me has now changed. I used to, like, my little routine was, you know, Costco, Farm Boy, LCBO, Kettleman's bagels, all in one morning.
Right.
I can't do that now. So I do two of them, right?
The lineups are really starting to get to me.
It just takes longer. But the other thing I noticed,
I feel like I'm in the Soviet Union lining up for bread.
I know. But then you get in the store and there's way more room And it's and there's less of a checkout line. I noticed that at Loblaws this weekend. I was worried about the I had an hour because I dropped my son off at dance, which was has restarted up, which is another normal thing, which is great. And I had an hour, so I lined up and I'm like, oh no, I'm not going to make it. Took a while to get through the line, about 10 minutes, and then I got into the store and I whipped through everything and there was no line at the cashier. So I,
yeah, you
I
have just, to be careful not to be discouraged by the lineup. Yeah. Some of them are really big, but they move fast.
They move fast, and they are there for a reason. And I just think, you know, I think we're all going to roll with it. I think we're all going to roll with it because we have no choice.
Yeah, here's the problem, though. Mm. If we get too used to it and too relaxed, then we end up what we're seeing in some U.S. states. And it's interesting. Dr. Dworkin and I were just talking about it. But it's interesting. Some states that have reopened quickly are actually not seeing a real uptick in numbers. Others are. And it's hard to know this early on whether that's just an aberration, just a statistical anomaly, or what's right. going on. But one theory is that in the states where they're opening up, but people are still very compliant. They're more likely to wear masks. They're conscious of social distancing. Those states may end up doing better than the ones where people are kind of being rebellious. You know, I'm not going to wear the mask. And it was always overstated anyway. And they got it wrong. And so I'm going to go back to totally normal. They may learn a harsh reality.
Yeah.
In seeing their numbers tick back up. Then they have to shut down their yeah. states again.
Well, and you know L.A., like L.A. and California was very aggressive, generally speaking. And they are spiking. Why are they spiking? You know, it's. I mean, these are big cities where lots of people are stacked up, where they've got a lot of people in the service industry who've had to go to work and continue. So why are they like what's happening there? And New York is not seeing that resurgence because New York has been through a nightmare already, right? Like, and the other thing you got, everybody's got to remember, like nobody got this wrong necessarily. They made mistakes, but they didn't know anything. Like, this is not the flu. This thing is only a few months old. I'm willing to give these health officials a bit of, you know, leeway here because, you know, don't wear a mask, wear a mask. You told us not to. Now you told – well, sometimes things change and shift, right? They have
yeah, I think on the mask thing, we're still – there are a lot of epidemiologists who still don't think masks do much good. So it's right. still split, but it was – they should have known, or like they've had years to plan for this pandemic. Yeah, we were told in Canada,
fair. That's all fair.
SARS taught us a lesson and we were more ready than anyone else. The mask thing is still a common sense thing, right? How yeah. much good does it really do? We don't know. But it's like sneezing or coughing or speaking into your sleeve. It's probably a little better than just coughing and spitting all
air,
over
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
or into your hand and then yeah. shaking hands. So that they should have gotten right, yeah. right from the start. Part of it is, though, they're playing this psychological game with us. And even when they're being a bit honest with it, well, if you wear a mask, you're more likely to touch your face. And in other words, they didn't trust us to do it properly.
Yeah.
They should have just said that, been more clear about it, said, we don't really know. We think it can't do any harm. It's probably better to wear it than not wear it. But there are no guarantees because we don't understand. That's been part of the problem. Like what's going on with OC Transpo right now.
Right.
Don't call it mandatory when it's not mandatory. Because what happens is people lose faith and respect for authorities. They think they're full of it. And that's what we're seeing in the U.S., this battle where a mask has become a political statement and not a health decision. And I don't want to see that happen here. When the mayor says it's mandatory to wear a mask on OC Transpo.
Right.
But they won't kick you off and they won't fine you. So is it really mandatory?
Right.
No.
Why not just say it's preferable?
And they're
betting on people. Because here's the thing. If they say it's preferable, fewer people will do it. If they say it's mandatory, more people will do it.
Sure, but
I know what you're saying, but they're not going to dedicate staff to go around and be mask police,
right?
Because that increases.
But my point is, they're playing the psychological game.
Yeah.
If you say it's mandatory, some people won't wear it. You say it's preferred, even more people won't wear it. I get that.
Right.
The problem is when you do that with everything. No one believes anything anymore.
Yeah,
when you say it is absolutely dangerous to do X, we'll say, well, is that really true, though, or is this another manipulation?
And
that's the longer-term problem with not being more upfront.
And what we're seeing in the States and in other countries and partially in Canada, too, is that cynicism that the media is lying to them, the politicians are lying to them, that we have been dealing with for years now. In a pandemic environment where no one's lying to you, like I don't have any problem going on the air and saying, look, no one is lying to you. They will make mistakes. So will reporters. But they are not trying to pull one off over you. On the mask thing, I think they did in early days. They didn't know if they had enough masks for medical workers. So they didn't want to come out and say, everybody go get a mask, because they'd lose 10% of the medical masks to the public. But they can't
but
go
say
out
that.
And, well, they could have.
Make a homemade mask, because we need those other masks.
We need
for
those other masks. They should have been more clear.
Yeah, and what they should do with OC Transpo and say it's mandatory. And you don't have to find many people, because you know, I'm going to tune into the 6 o'clock news, and Graham and Patricia are going to say, good evening. Three people were fined today for refusing to wear masks on OC Transpo.
Right.
And that will be enough. You don't have to stop everybody. You just start handing out random fines. And I think they should have. I think they should have made it legitimately mandatory. Look, it's public transit. I don't care what your political opinion is on this, or even your personal opinion. You're going to go on public transit where you may put other people at risk. You're going to wear a mask, or you're not going to ride the train.
Yeah. Early on, it's funny, you know, early on, I jumped on the bus on the way in. It was March. It was April. I jumped on the bus. There were three or four people on the bus. It was cut off at the front, and I didn't have my mask. And those three other people had the masks. Oh, did I get dirty looks? I was only on for about 10 minutes.
I know. It's like being the only dressed guy on a nude beach.
It's true. It's true. And since then, I've worn a mask, and then they announced you got to wear masks. And actually,
happened to me once. I stumbled on a nude beach, and I was the only guy wearing a bathing suit. And I felt really self-conscious about it. And my girlfriend at the time said, well, then just take it off. I said, I'm not that embarrassed.
Not that embarrassed.
It's a measure of degrees of embarrassment.
We're not talking about nude beaches. But we do have Alan Hubley on shortly, right after the handover here.
And he'll be wearing pants.
He will be.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about masks, not and OC Transpo, not.
Well, I'll leave it to you and Alan.
Yeah. Great to talk, Bill. And it's going to be a gorgeous week, huh? It's going to go up, get hot. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful week.
Great day to be a nude beachist.
That's Bill Carroll.
Nude beachist.
Thanks, Bill. I'm Graham Richardson. I won't ask you about the nude beach thing.
There's none in Kanata South, for the record.
Well, you never know. I've heard about Kanata. No, I'm just kidding. The idea here is you are going to rely on passengers' goodwill and moral suasion from other passengers. And the message is, if you're heading there, if you're taking transit, please bring a cloth mask.
Yes, and we have some available for those that may have forgotten their mask or lost it along the way, like they do fall out of people's pockets and so on. And we've set this period at the start to try to ease into this as much as possible. I get what Bill was saying about the using the term mandatory, but we're not the only municipality that's doing this, because the goal is to get to mandatory. And we've set this date. We're doing the phase-in piece, but for those that don't want to wear masks, they need to get ready for this.
What is there has been some? I think it's fading. I think the consensus on masks has become more solid. Interesting anecdote, Alan. My son was at Western this year. His roommate's from Hong Kong. In January, my son's roommate had masks sent to him from his family and asked Jack, you want to wear a mask? You want one of my masks? And Jack looked at him like he had two heads. And all of the students from Asian countries at Western University started to wear masks in January, February. And I mean, I think partially Vancouver's success has been their robust Asian population, their experience with these kinds of viruses, and the fact that they are still speaking with people back home in many ways, and they just don't mess around with it and they put on a mask. And I think, generally speaking, North America, I hear what's going on in the United States and I understand that, but I see more and more masks out there, and I think people are buying that this might be some sort of protection. What is your sense?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I was at Tunney's yesterday with the mayor for a while. We were handing out free masks. And I can tell you, and this is the day before it actually becomes mandatory, my own personal view of it is I think about 80% of the people already had their masks, had it on, or they, if you go to offer them one, they'd say, oh, I got one in my pocket, and we'd just remind them that tomorrow, or like today, they're going to start to be mandatory. But I was surprised at how high the ratio was already yesterday, and the early reports I'm getting from this morning is it's very, very good. Like, there's a very high compliance rate to this already.
I think boring old Ottawa in many ways has served us well. And when I say boring old Ottawa, don't get offended, please. What I mean is we are a highly educated city. We listen to instructions. We're not a city of rebels that does its own thing. And I think overall, generally speaking, that sort of what are the officials saying? What is the medical community saying? What are my colleagues doing? Has served us very well, and I'm not at all surprised at the city of Ottawa. People on transit today have followed direction and are wearing masks. Are you?
I'm really happy about it. I'll say that. I will also agree with what you had said to Bill about the need for us to make sure that the message is believable and that we have some rationale as to why we're asking this. We've got to be careful about what we're asking people to do, because right now there is that belief that we are only telling them good information, or at least the best information we have at this time. And we've got to be so careful with that, because as soon as you cross over that and say the wrong thing, you lose your support.
And I think there is a, as you would know, you're on the firing line of the public, and I know you, all politicians face this cynicism and skepticism, and the notion that I would argue seems to be growing that everyone is trying to pull one over on the public and give them bad information for whatever reason. There's an agenda or whatever. How complicated, given that environment, which I don't think is out of control in Canada, but is certainly there, given that environment, how challenging has it been to communicate during a pandemic about urgent medical issues like masks, like long-term care, like stay at home, from your perspective?
Everything about this pandemic has been challenging, Graham. Like, I've been in public service for a number of years, and I've never seen anything like this where, you know, look, I worked during the power outage. Remember that time we lost the power for over a week, and that I was one of the essential services that had to be in and work through all that. And I compare it a bit to that time, because you didn't know in the morning what you were going to be doing by the end of the day, and you'd come out with a set of guidelines or rules as to how things were going to work, and by the next day you have more information, and that has to change. And that's the way this has been all through here. When it comes to the masks, so I think most people realize we're not doing this to push them around. We're doing this to keep them safe and get them to help us keep the other people on the bus safe. It's not a matter of Big Brother saying this is what to do. It's we're trying to help you.
All right, Alan Hubley, the chair of the Transit Commission, we appreciate you being on. And again, if you're taking transit today, first day that masks are mandatory. We've seen good compliance out there, and there is some scientific basis to this, that if you are a carrier and don't know it of the virus, keeping a mask on your face while you're not able to keep social distance may keep your infection rate even slightly lower, and that's the goal here. Trying to stop the spread. Alan Hubley, always great to talk to you. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Graham. Anytime.
All right. That's Alan Hubley. And we are going to take a short break. And after the break on the program, we're going to talk to an epidemiologist at the University of Ottawa about social circles. Ontario announced the expansion of social circles on Friday. And if you weren't watching closely, it's kind of confusing because we went from 5 to 10. This is a separate thing. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts. Ottawa at Work, we're back in just a moment. Stay with us. Can I go where
you go? This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Graham Richardson, sitting in on this Monday for Leslie Roberts. He's back tomorrow. Great to be here with you. The sun is shining and we have good news. Things are on the COVID front, things are looking good. across the country. And I want to talk to somebody about that who's joining us now. Dr. Rewat Dionandan, an epidemiologist at the University of Ottawa. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being on again.
Thank you.
I know we're going to talk about other things like circles and everything. I've noticed how do you describe this?
The reproduction number.
The reproduction, it's looking good across the country, isn't it?
It is, depending upon what metric you use to calculate it and which time frame you use. But yeah, in general, it's looking pretty good.
I'm seeing one now from David Fisman, who's well known, and he put out Ontario at 0.54, Quebec at 0.67. There's a hotspot in Alberta at 1.29. He believes is quite localized, and this is the infection rate. And back in March, we were much higher than that, triple or quadruple that. Is that correct?
Yeah, Fisman's the man. I would never disagree with him, so he knows what he's talking about. So it looks like we're trending in the right direction, but the calculation of the reproduction number instantaneously can change in a couple of days, depending upon what we observe now.
Yes.
So this is all with a grain of salt. It's looking good, but we can't take our foot off the pedal.
And what we've learned, I think, is that we don't know enough about this thing, and it can change rapidly. And you sit there, look at our infection rate. Let's open a beach. And that can change, you can't make these rash decisions, right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, what we do know about this disease is that it loves mass gatherings. Mm. And about 80% of the transmission, we think, is caused by 20% of the infected people. And those 20% are in mass gatherings like churches and bars and parties and beaches. So if we can avoid those situations, I think we've got a good chance of keeping this under control.
That's great. And I'm reminded of the church in Korea. I'm reminded of the soccer game in Italy and Mardi Gras in New Orleans. All of those things a few months ago appear to have been major events.
Yes, we call them super spreading events. And of course, we've had the protests and demonstrations recently. So
right.
Everyone's holding their breath to see what happens
next.
So it's
a good point. That's a good point. Let's talk about social circles.
Okay.
So if I understand this correctly from the province, and it's complicated, but I use my own family, and I emailed my father and my stepmother. They have been isolated. They're in their, my dad's in his 80s, healthy, but he hasn't seen anybody, and they live together. And by my calculation, he can now visit my brother, family of four, and he can visit his wife's daughter, family of three, but only those two to keep them under 10 people. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's about it. Now, a few things to keep in mind here. First of all, this rule of 10, that number came out of nowhere. I have no idea how that was chosen, but it's a small enough number that we can manage as a society. And the idea is that beyond those 10, you don't socialize beyond those numbers, and that way, if an infection does arise, it's unlikely to spread beyond these cells. But the important part to me is, do you trust the people in your 10, in your circle, not to be flagrantly seeking infection elsewhere? If you have a teenager in your group, for example, is this person hanging out with their friends in the park and not telling you? These are the kinds of things that, fill me with a little bit of discomfort as this unfolds.
Yes. So the teenager is a good example. And if you have a teenager and you are not able to convince them only to hang out with you anymore because it's been a long 2.5 months, 3 months, if they are keeping their distance, and if they are just with one or two friends or a handful of friends, are you comfortable with that or not?
Well, it's overt about it, but
yes,
that's the nature of the game, right? So the idea here is, if enough people follow these rules, then the transmission rate at a population level will go down. So this is never about individual risk. It's hard to make predictions about individuals. That's not how this works. It's about maintaining the level of transmission in the community below a certain number. It's like wearing masks. Not everyone has to wear them, but enough have to wear them. Or vaccination. Not everyone needs to get it, but enough people need to get it. The same thing applies to the circles. Not everyone needs to conform to these rules, but most people do. And that's how we get the reproduction number staying below one.
I see also that the UK is talking about 1 meter, not two. And I'm also reminded of Prince Charles, who went into 7 days with coronavirus and then came out, not 14. What are we to take of this speculation in the UK that 1 meter might be okay?
So there are no hard and fast rules. Everything is based on averages. And the two-meter rule we have here is based on research going back to the 1930s, and mostly about influenza. It's based on the distance that the droplets travel typically. Now, in general, that's about 2 meters, but sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. And for about most people, you're less likely to get infected if someone is more than a meter or so away from you. Mm-hmm. So 1 meter is used in China and Denmark and France, 1.4 meters in South Korea, 1.5 meters in Australia and Germany, and we use 2 meters here. With every additional meter, your risk goes down by half or so. So, and that's not the entire metric here. I mean, it's not just distance, it's how long you spend near somebody. I'm more comfortable walking by a bunch of people who are a foot away from me, who are just passing by quickly, than I am having a conversation with someone 2 meters away.
Or being at a football game.
Exactly right.
Right.
So the duration of exposure matters at least as much as the distance.
Yeah. And we have seen, I think, and I do have to wrap up, but we have seen that this has caused a lot of anxiety these last few months, and I've noticed a lot of shaming and finger-pointing. What's your message to those people who may lash out at Costco at someone for getting too close by accident?
Again, this is not about individual risk. If someone walks by you, you're probably fine. It's on average, if enough people do their part, the numbers come down. And this is something citizens have to be responsible about. We're all in this together.
It's an excellent message, Dr. Rewat Dhiyanandan. And thanks so much for being here again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. There you go. So think about it as averages and generally speaking, as opposed to don't stand here. I'm going to lash out at you because you're too close to me. I think that's a really important message, because if enough people get the message to stay 2 meters apart, even though sometimes people might be inside a meter close to you for a few brief seconds, that doesn't mean they might have made a mistake. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Be kind. And the sun is shining. Remember, the sun is shining. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts. I'm past the news time here. We want to break for the CTV News, and we are back in just a moment. Stay with us.
This is News Talk 580 CFRA, Ottawa's home for breaking news.
Good morning. I'm Chris Holsky. It's 10:30. Here are the top stories from CTV News. And we begin with breaking news. A man has suffered life-threatening injuries in a crash between Orleans and Navan. It happened at about 8:37 near Trim and Wall, both roads closed in the area. Paramedics say a man in his 40s was rushed to hospital.
This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Graham Richardson sitting in for Leslie Roberts. Ottawa at Work here on a beautiful Monday morning. The darkest spot in this pandemic and over the last several months obviously has been long-term care and retirement homes beyond a hotspot. It's been a tragedy in many, many places. Short drive from here for multiple deaths. Joe Princiotta is the owner of Orchard View by the Mississippi. We have him on the line. And your facility, Joe, if I'm not mistaken, did quite well. And I know it was a challenge. Tell me what worked.
Good morning, Graham. Thank you for having me on, first of all.
It's great to hear you.
We shut down back in March and, restricting. We basically took our place and sheltered it from the community, really. And we didn't allow, and it's been challenging, and it still is challenging, not allowing visitors in. We've been doing the visitation through the window type of thing with all our residents and everything. So, I mean, we shut down back in March, and we just continue to do so, and we're staying the path, basically. And as a result of that, thankfully, thank God, we haven't had a case here. And I've been...
No cases?
No cases, no.
How many residents?
160.
160 residents, no cases. What have you done with your employees?
So the employees, we educate them. We have a meeting once a week with all of our employees. They come in from home as well. And so we just educate them. The younger ones, we tell them, you have to stay the path and try to minimize any type of interaction with anybody outside of here. We've been just educating. I think that's the thing, and we're just blessed with the people we have here, and how good they are, and how you know, it's funny because on a regular work week before COVID, you'd have Colin sick, and you'd have some nurses would call in sick or PSWs, sure, whatever, dietary. But during this whole time, it's been down to nothing really. I mean, nobody's been calling in sick. Everybody's just, they're part of an amazing team that we have here, and they've been, everybody's on board with it. But I think it's more about educating and motivating and telling them this is a serious case here, and we really have to all work together. And you know, the residents as well, working together, and they're understanding what we're doing, which is amazing too, you know.
And luckily where you are, there have been low cases, but that was also true in Bob Cajun. So once this gets in, you know, I've heard it described as it spreads like a forest fire. So one case could wipe out a floor in your facility, right?
100%, and that's what, you know, that's why I have so many sleepless nights, because you don't know. So I've been fighting for testing for all of our staff and our residents, and I've been fighting for this for months and months and months. Finally, we have a public health here at Lanark that didn't really believe in the testing part of it. And so we got permission to obtain tests, so we did it ourselves. So a week and a half ago, we tested all of our residents and all of our staff. I think we did 190 tests.
So wait a sec, but my understanding was the province was saying every long-term care home.
Yeah, we're not long-term care.
You're not long-term, your retirement.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Right, so they're starting now, the retirement homes now, finally, their public health are releasing tests to us now, so we're going to be doing another, so we're testing every 14 days.
Right.
That's the mandate. That's what we want to do. Now, on Friday, we were throwing a huge curveball. I'm not sure even if you know this or not, but the Ministry for Seniors and Accessibility, they sent out a communique that basically allows our residents to leave now for 12 hours to go visit, go to a restaurant, go shopping, whatever. So we're going to, this is implemented, and it starts June 18th.
As of June 18th, if there is no outbreak in a retirement home,
correct,
residents are permitted to leave.
Correct.
Okay. And what's your take on that? Is it too early from your perspective?
Well, of course it is. I mean, it's idiotic.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we're trying to protect them, the residents, and by the government doing this, I mean, now, 90% of our residents are amazing, you know, but there are 10% there, and I understand where they're coming from. They're saying, look, the government's letting us leave here, and, you want us to stay, and it's my job to try to convince them to say, you know, you don't have to stay. I'm not going to imprison them, but on the same token, you know, we've done such a great job for the last 3 months. Let's just stay the path a little longer and reassess it, let's say, June 30th and see how it is out there. Because, I mean, and they're also saying visitors are allowed to come in. They're allowed to go up to our resident, the respective rooms of their family members. And again, we're not allowing that. We're gonna allow face-to-face visitation only if the family member gets tested and they're tested negative, and they'd be able to visit with our resident, but still observe 6 feet apart. But we're doing it outside, weather permitting, and if it's raining or whatever, we'll designate a spot inside our building to do so.
But how long can you, I mean, these are human beings, obviously. They need human connection. They need to do things. How long can you maintain, stay in the facility, do not go out, even if the government's allowing you to go out?
As long as we can.
Right.
As long as we can. I mean, I meet with my directors every single day, and we talk about this, and we throw it around the room, and we're all in consensus. Look, we're here to protect them. And we protect our residents, and we're here to do so, and we have to do everything in our power to protect them. And, you know, again, if it makes common sense as well, right?
Yeah.
Because
there is the other side, like, there are the side effects of the pandemic in keeping them physically safe, right? There's the mental health toll this is taking on all ages. And it's that constant balance, you know, between life and risk and managing that risk. And I hear you that you're not at the point where you're comfortable allowing more risk. I appreciate you probably understand legally you can't stop anybody from leaving now that the government's allowed them. But I guess my question is, you know, do you have any idea when you're going to get at that point where you're going to be comfortable allowing them to go?
I think when we're all comfortable outside in the outside world up here, if we're comfortable that, you know, people go walk around and they don't have, like, there's, you know, the cases, like right now I heard the cases are at 181 today, so it's the lowest, you know, since they started.
Yeah, and the infection rate in Lanark is excellent. Like, it's,
yeah.
Do you have cases in Lanark? I don't believe you do.
No, I don't think so either. So, I mean, that's a good thing, and I agree with that. So, I mean, it's getting there, and we're getting there. I mean, but then it's just the nonsensical stuff. Like, for example, RHRA, which is our regulatory body for retirement homes.
Yes.
You know, they're stating that we still have to have one person at a table sitting down in our dining room.
Right.
Which, again, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I mean, people are allowed to sit. People are allowed, like, we own a restaurant in Almont here. So people are allowed to go to the door of the restaurant. Six people could sit at a table. We're not obliged to ask them where they're from or if they're from the same family. They could be independent people from six different houses. They could sit in our restaurant and they could have a meal. But in our own retirement home, which we are protecting and we're making sure that everybody's safe and everybody is safe, they're not allowed to sit with each other in our retirement home.
Right.
So that's nonsensical. And that's stuff that we need to get changed and the ministry has to change this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, it's frustrating, as you can tell from my voice.
Yeah.
It's just so frustrating.
Well, listen, Joe, great to talk to you, and thanks so much for coming on, and congratulations. I know it's been, I can't imagine the stress in long-term care and retirement homes trying to keep people alive, and that's clearly what you're trying to do. And it's, you know, as we pull out of this as a province and as a country, the long-term care, I know you're retirement, but the long-term care situation, the notion that so many have died, you know, and it didn't happen in BC. It didn't happen in Kingston, for instance. Like, why did it happen in places, you know?
Yeah.
And that will forever be, was it staffing? Like, was it your suggestion on education? Was it material? Was it the four to a room? The older buildings, you know.
I think it is that. But, I mean, I think they had to be inspected more often.
Yeah.
And but I think there's going to be major changes in long-term care now. I hope there are.
There has to be. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. That is Joe Prinziotta. He is the owner of Orchard View by the Mississippi, a well-known name here on the radio station. Interesting perspective. He does not want his residents to be going out. When we come back, we're going to talk with Chris Knight of Gusto Worldwide Media. He's calling in about the film in TV industry in Ottawa, the non-news film and TV industry. Can it survive? Can they make television? Can they make movies? Can they make commercials? Do all of those things? Wonderful industry in the age of COVID. What's it going to take to get them back up and running? And can they be back up and running? I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts. Stay with us. We're back in just a moment. Good. How are you? And I mean, where is the industry at? Where's your company at? And like I kind of look at, you know, CTV and CFRA in a certain sort of phase, much like, you know, we're getting close to welcoming people back, I think, you know, and expanding the people in the building. We're not there yet. But what about yours? What about film and television?
Well, we were, we were shooting up until February, and then as it happened, we went dark for a little bit when COVID really took over. So we've been out of production since March, and we're jonesing to get back next week. So it's, we have our own studio facility here. Some of the field productions that we were going to do here in Ottawa and in Toronto, we've pushed those to next year because I just don't think having a big crew running around in multiple locations right now is going to be feasible.
Right.
So we're very lucky that, you know, much like you guys with the news, we have our own studio.
Yeah.
So we control access and egress. You know, we're very particular about who we let in the building. We've had it completely deep cleaned. Everybody who's coming back to work on the show, I think we'll be the first production company in Ontario back. But we're doing all the protocols, of course. Everybody wears a mask. There's hand sanitizers everywhere. We've changed the way we shoot. But we're really excited about getting back in production.
So what's coming back next week? You're in phase. Are you in phase two? You've been allowed to start up again, or earlier than that?
No. So,
phase two.
You know,
okay.
Yeah. So we're in phase two for production. The broadcast side was always considered, you know, an exempt service. So we've had our broadcast side because we have feeds running all over the world. So that was running, and mainly those employees, those colleagues, were working from home. So this technology, as you know, right now is amazing, and the stuff you can do remote is crazy. But to make a television show, you need a bunch of people in the room.
Yeah.
And so that's once Premier Ford gave the thumbs up for Ottawa, we're hitting the ground running.
What is the biggest challenge you're facing?
Well, you know, listen, television, as you know, is fun, it's exciting, there's an adrenaline rush when you're in production. So from a creative point of view, it's keeping all of those things going while being mindful of the current situation. So it's trying to balance safety and security with creativity. And I think the biggest thing that we've done, and I think you're going to see with other productions, is we're now budgeting 50% more time to shoot a show, literally. So we're incurring the cost to slow everything down.
Mm.
So it's more expensive, but if we go slower and we're a little more mindful of, you know, who's around us and what it is that we're touching. We have a production assistant added to the crew whose job literally it is for 10 plus 1 hours a day is to walk around cleaning things. Somebody picks something up, they come in behind, they clean it down. So we're doing best practices to make sure everybody's safe, and we're going to have some fun making a TV show.
What remind people what the first one, like, what are you working on starting next week?
So we had a number of different programs in the lineup, and we've decided to go with a new series, a very high concept show called Combination Plates. And we picked that one to start with because there's one host on the show, and it's a smaller crew. And then as we get our production legs under us, we'll migrate into shows that have bigger crews and more people once we're sure that we're doing everything smart and safe.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. Baby steps. That's good. That's good.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
Well, you know, like full-on production.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Get how have you, by the way, I'm curious, how have you changed the way you shoot?
Well, you know, the camera guys, for instance, typically on a shoot, as you know, Graham, camera guys have an assistant.
Yeah.
So the assistant for the audience out there runs and swaps out batteries when a lens needs to be changed because cameras use different lenses depending on the shot the director calls. Typically, that's done by a camera assist. So that's not, from now on, all camera operators are responsible for all of their own gear. They're the only ones that touch it. Makeup, we do, for the host, we've done makeup sessions. But most of the powdering and everything, of course, they're going to have to do themselves now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're just slowing the process down because, as I said, people on a set get super hyper-focused on what they're doing. And we're just going to slow the whole process down so we're all not bumping into each other. That's the biggest part is slowing everything down.
Yeah. And it's kind of counterintuitive for this industry.
It totally
right?
is, yeah. right?
Go, go, go.
Go, go, go. Like, you know, the train has left the station. And, you know, once that production gets going, nothing gets in its way. So it's a bit of a rethinking. Now, we've had the facility locked down for 9 weeks now, and everybody wears a mask, and there's, as I said, there's cleaning stations everywhere. So it's a matter of getting into a rhythm, and everybody just kind of being mindful of what we're doing, and hopefully, you know, we'll still crush a really great show.
Yeah.
And get it out on the air.
What will it be like? Can the industry, like, I know your industry is in many ways is like an accordion. You're expanding very quickly, and then all of a sudden, you know, governments start doing things that cause it to go in a different direction. One place is doing better than the other. Can you get back to pre-COVID? How quickly can you get back to pre-COVID? Do you know?
I don't think we ever will. You know, and I think, you know, like Toronto did about $1 billion. That's with a B.
Wow.
Dollars in business of American service work, right?
Yeah.
Movies, TV shows, and everything. So right now the border isn't even open.
Right.
So getting talent up and down, and then as you know, when you get into really big productions, there's completion guarantees and bonds. You're shooting a $50 million movie. The insurance companies want to make sure there's going to be a wholesale rethinking on how everything gets done. It's going to be interesting to see what comes out at the end of it. Television is tremendously amount of fun.
Yeah.
Certainly people are watching more content now, whether it's, you know, on Netflix or on a streaming channel or, you know, a live channel. People are watching more content than they ever have been, which is, of course, the great irony.
Yes. We're facing the exact same thing.
Yes.
Our consumption is off the charts,
but
advertising has changed.
to
say the least, right?
Yeah.
So it's
we have channels running. Like we have a Mandarin subtitled channel running in Singapore. We have Spanish versions of our channel going into Latin America. Viewership's through the roof.
Yeah.
But the advertising revenues, as you know, just haven't gone there because when people, you know, are financially worried about their companies, the first thing they cut is their advertising budget.
Right. Right.
So, you know, it's a great irony.
Yeah.
But we're very, very lucky. First of all, we have a partnership here in Canada with Bell Media, and we're really lucky that we have our own production facility here that we use exclusively for ourselves. So we don't have to worry about who was in here the week before.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
You know,
that's
who's
good.
The guy pushing the broom.
I'm because of consumption, like I would be up nights now if consumption throughout this, like the pandemic has made the argument for what you do and for what we do here.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're kind of getting grouped in with essential workers at the height of the pandemic. And what was odd about the pandemic was, like, unlike 9/11, the local story was the most important because we could tell people what to do and what not to do based on what's happening around the corner. So yes, it was an international massive story, but the local story was the most important to everybody watching here,
oh,
you know?
Sure.
And on your side, you know, people are at home and they're streaming. They've got all this access to all this content that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, would be a completely different picture, you know?
Yep.
So someone somewhere smart is going to have to come up with, okay, we've got all these eyeballs and all this public interest, right? Mm-hmm. And somehow someone's going to have to, anyway, I'm sure smarter minds will sort it out. I just know that, like, with consumption where it's at, I think that is, generally speaking, a positive. As long as you acknowledge that the ground is shifting underneath you, and there's not much you can do about it as a content producer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you're absolutely right, and arguably, when things go back to the new normal and people are allowed out a little bit more, their consumption will go down.
Yes.
But I think people's viewing patterns have changed tremendously as well.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
You know, Gusto is a sticky channel in that people turn it on and leave it on.
Yes.
But so CTV News.
Right.
I have CTV News running in the background all the time.
Right.
Because
I
want to know what's happening, you know, locally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Anyway, great to talk to you, Chris. Thanks so much for this.
Merci, monsieur.
And good luck. It's great to see you back up and running.
Okay, cheerio.
Chris Knight with Gusto Worldwide talking to us about production getting back on its feet. It's 11 o'clock. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts. Let's head to the CTV newsroom for your local, international, national news on what's happening right now.
This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to Ottawa at Work. I'm Graham Richardson sitting in for Leslie Roberts on this beautiful Monday morning. I'm always amazed at what's going on with my phone and the apps I use and the location tracking. But this one really surprised me when I read it over the weekend, that Tim Hortons, it sounds like, has been using apps and location tracking to see when people go to their customers. When they go to their competitors, not when they go to Tim's. Carmi Levy is a regular contributor here and on CTV News, is an expert on technology. He joins us now. Hi, Carmi.
Good morning, Graham.
Do I have this right? That they essentially were using data, access they had to data, or they bought access to data that told them when people were going to their competitors?
Yep. So when you install the Tim Hortons app, most of us don't bother reading the screens that pop up when we install any app. We're in such a rush to get it working. But one of the screens that comes up is a privacy. You know, it wants to access certain parts of your phone. So location services, the camera, the microphone, things like that. And we most usually just, you know, press yes because we just want it to work. So that's what we're doing, is we've granted the app permission to tap into our location data. And of course, your phone has a GPS chip on it. It knows where it is at any given time. And then it logs that information from that moment forward. And then it sends it back to the mothership saying, okay, you know, this is Graham Richardson's phone. This is where he goes. This is when he went to a Tim's. And this is when he went to a Starbucks or he went to a McDonald's.
So Tim's, when I downloaded the Tim's app, I accepted certain things that I probably didn't read. Right. And then did Tim's then go do something like buy another application or data to do something else that I did not know about?
Yes. Well, what they're doing, you're giving them kind of, when you install the app, you give them blanket access, and that's really what you agreed to. And then in the background, once they have that information, they then... And the terms of use or terms of service statement, also that most of us aren't reading, makes it very clear that they reserve the right to take that information that they gather and share it with whatever third-party companies they wish.
See, when I see that, when I read that, I always assume that's a market survey thing. Like, here's what Graham's consuming at Tim Hortons, so maybe we'll find, 20,000 Graham Richardsons and change the menu. This is something different. This is like... how many Tim Hortons people are going to our competitors?
It is, and it's all part of, it all falls under the big marketing umbrella. They want to learn more about you so that they can then target you with much more specific offerings. Of course, the more they know about you, that's kind of the holy grail of marketers.
Yeah.
Then they can create products and services and experiences that match right up to you.
Yeah.
So what they'll do is they'll take that information. They have a deal with a company called Radar Labs that claims to raise location awareness and marketing to the next level. Right. And they take that data and they massage it and they help them figure out what they should do with it. So this is all, it's quote unquote legit, quote unquote legal. Is it, because we agreed to it, is it kind of moral? Well, it sort of pushes the bounds of privacy a little bit, because now a whole lot of very personal and private pieces of your life are in fact being gathered, massaged, and used to sell more stuff to you.
Yeah, and they're not the only ones, obviously.
Like, pick up your phone right now, take a look at every app on your phone.
Yeah.
Every app is doing it. And so this is, in this particular case, we're talking about Tim Hortons, but the truth of the matter is everyone is into this. And if you're not, you're not being competitive. You're not doing everything you can to understand your customer. And, for better or for worse, the way you understand your customer today is you look at their phone and you analyze how it's being used. And part of that is, even if you're not physically touching this, it's just sitting in your pocket. Just as you go through the pace of your day, you wander through the city, you do your stuff. You pick up your dry cleaning, you grab dinner, whatever, you head home. Those patterns of behavior and activity, that's very strong insight for a company like, in this case, Tim Hortons, but it could be for any other company that wants to sell us stuff.
Yeah. So I've got the Starbucks app. I'm a Starbucks customer. I'll have the odd dark roast at Tim Hortons. One of the things I found about Tim Hortons over the years, before Starbucks came to Canada, I found the coffee not strong enough. So theoretically, they could look, if I had the Tim Hortons app and they found that I was going to Starbucks a lot and there's enough of me, they could do something like offer more stronger coffee, which they did with the dark roast. I'm sure that I'm not the only one.
Absolutely. Or you in particular might get a coupon, an electronic coupon saying, hey, it's been a while since we saw you. Come on back and we'll give you a number one or something like that. So it can really customize the experience based on where you go. You know, on the one hand, and most of us have already decided this is a trade-off that we're willing to make. We're willing to give up the privacy so that we have better consumer experiences time and again. But if you want to sort of rein it in, you know, we need to spend a little bit more time looking at the settings, both on our apps and on our operating systems, to get familiar with them. Because just because you've installed the app doesn't mean you have to grant it carte blanche access. You can dial it back. You just have to go into the settings and play with it a little bit.
And it takes time to do that, and a lot of people aren't willing to do that.
That's right.
And we're go, go, go. But maybe the pandemic has caused us to maybe, hey, let's just take a moment here and pause.
That's right. Many of us do have the time, and also look at the apps. If you haven't used the app in a number of months, get rid of it, because once you get rid of it, then it's no longer collecting. And that is probably the best way to kind of close that gap a little bit and ensure that you're only sharing with companies you're comfortable sharing with, and you're only getting the benefit back. You're not exposing yourself unnecessarily to companies that don't deserve to have access to that information.
It's kind of like cleaning out your closet, right? Like, you just every once in a while, you got to clean off your phone, just get rid of stuff you don't use. I always get the warning when I'm close to data max, and I've got to, you know, ditch some pictures and all that sort of stuff. That, hold on a sec here. What are all these apps I have? I'm not using this anymore. It's amazing. They're indispensable, but they're also indispensable to marketers. It's another reminder.
Yeah, it cuts both ways, and I think we have to start thinking about how much are we willing to give up in order to have this, you know, digital consumer lifestyle of ours. And to a certain extent, I think we as consumers can do a better job drawing that line. So, you know, we're going to take control of our phones a little bit more than we have in the past. We're not just going to assume that everyone's operating in our best interest. We're going to take the time to, you know, cull the herd a little bit, get rid of apps that we're not using, tighten our security features and our privacy features so that only the companies that we really want to have a meaningful relationship with, they're the only ones that are collecting, and everyone else, well, they can collect from someone else.
Fair enough. Carmi Levy, that's great advice. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Graham.
All right. Carmi Levy's our tech expert, and he has been joining us talking about the Tim Hortons app, what it's doing, and how it's tracking where you're going and drinking coffee, maybe not even at Tim Hortons, other places. We are waiting for the Prime Minister's address on the COVID update, on the COVID-19 update, and also that's going to come up in the next few moments. And the other thing I know the Prime Minister is going to be asked about, there was another shooting in New Brunswick. An Indigenous person was shot and killed by the RCMP. Some of the details are out, not all of them are out, and there have been increasing calls and questions about systemic racism, about communities like Indigenous Canadians and their interactions with police, in particular the RCMP, and whether there needs to be a full step change and a closer look at that relationship. We in this country have often looked to the United States with a certain "we're not as bad as them"-ism. And if you talk to a person of color in a city, particularly young black men, or Indigenous Canadians, particularly in some of our cities and smaller towns in the northern parts of the country, they will have a different perspective on that. I'm not saying police are racist. I'm not saying that. But there is this notion that Canada is a tolerant society, and we are multicultural and we celebrate everybody's differences. And, you know, you talk to people who aren't white, they have a different perspective about their interactions with police. You know, I've talked to some parents who have kids who are not white, and they're worried about when they get older and what it means right here in Canada, right here in Canada. So not everybody agrees, and but I think generally speaking, since these massive protests have broken out around the world, I think we have moved beyond the discussion of whether we have systemic racism or not in Canada. I think we do, and I think there's ample evidence that we do. And I think we're now moving to a discussion about what to do about it. Because you simply cannot argue that I went to Attawapiskat in the early 2000s because they didn't have drinking water, and I wasn't the first reporter to go there. It's a Northern Ontario First Nation, and they still don't have drinking water. There's a diesel spill underneath the high school, and the high school's uninhabitable, and it's minus 50. You know, like, if that happened in Ottawa, that'd be fixed right away. And it's still a problem there today, you know? So when people say, I don't know what you're talking about, we don't have systemic racism, how do you square that circle? I just don't think you can. Here's the Prime Minister. We're going to take this now. He's talking about COVID-19, and we'll listen in at Ottawa at Work.
This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back. I'm Graham Richardson, in for Leslie Roberts on this beautiful Monday. Things have shifted for a lot of the economy as of Friday. Most of Ontario into phase two. We'll see if the GTA, Hamilton area, and all those other areas that are not in phase two are in phase two at some point this week or later next week. I'm sure there's a lot of anxious people hoping for that as the infection rate continues to go down, which is a good thing. I mentioned earlier the manufacturing numbers are just stunning, the plunge in manufacturing. Even worse is the travel industry. No one's, like, travel has just disappeared for a lot of people. And what is flying going to look like? Can you wrap your head around packing up the family and getting on a plane and going somewhere, even in the next year? Barry Twa is a personal finance and travel expert. He joins us now. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
What should we get ready for if we're going to turn our minds towards travel at some point? How different will the experience be?
Depends on where you're going, right? I think right now a lot of people are looking to travel within their provinces first as things slowly start to open up. People are thinking about the staycations, whatever is within driving distance, because obviously if you live within a province, presumably you know the provincial rules more than anything else.
Right.
So I think that's the biggest thing right now, the immediate things. And of course, people are thinking about international travel, but there's a lot of what-ifs still.
Yeah. So we go locally, you know, moving around the city. Then we go provincially for staycations. Mm-hmm. Then eventually, in the next little while, we'll think about interprovincial and Canadian travel. And
That's
then
right.
The next step would be international.
That's the way I would look at it personally. Yeah. I think it's the right thing to do. You know, the Canadian economy, everyone knows, is taking a beating. It's a perfect opportunity to explore Canada. I've been here my entire life, and I'm sad to say I've only been to probably three provinces.
Right.
It's time to fix that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And what is your sense on, I wonder about even when the U.S. border mm-hmm. opens, the comfort level with going to the United States for many people, right?
Yeah, this has been almost a perfect storm for the U.S. In the worst way possible. Obviously, the border's closed right now. So as soon as the border opens, I don't think there's going to be Canadians rushing to go down. Even if they had plans this year, they may forget them all entirely. Because number one, I think Canadians are concerned about how the U.S. has handled COVID, basically. Yes. You know, you've seen certain states try to lock things down. States have opened up. We're seeing reoccurrence cases of phase two, whatever you want to call it. And then obviously now from a political standpoint, Canadians are already concerned, social issues down south. I think a lot of Canadians are worried about what's going down in the U.S. for multiple levels, and that's enough for them to stay home or consider other destinations right now.
And, you know, if we're in the middle of February and the infection rate is low, maybe that will change. There have always been problems with race. There's always been problems mm-hmm. With extreme poverty and extreme wealth in the United States. Their cities are beautiful. You go to, you know, a Washington, a New York City, and they're world-class cities, and very close by the world-class cities, you have grinding poverty. And I think travelers know that. I agree with you, though. This feels like a much more significant shift. People may wait to see how it turns out before they book a multi-$1,000 trip down there with the family to Disneyland.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other factors in play, not just race and poverty.
Yes.
I think Canadians or travelers all over around the world, they're really starting to see the impact of what no travel means for the world. I think people are starting to, you hear about countries where the air pollution has gone down, it's better for residents. I think travelers are just going to be like, hey, you know what, do I want to be a responsible traveler moving forward? Is ecotourism going to be more important than a sustainable traveler? How can I be smart without leaving a huge carbon footprint for my children or generations to come? You talked about Disney World and Orlando, and I honestly think that's probably the one place that won't be affected as much because they're kind of right. in their own little bubble in the sense that people love theme parks. Even sure. I admit that I love theme parks.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
And you've got certain fans that will go. But I think the more important thing is, like, what does air travel down there mean? You know, the government's already introduced new regulations about temperature checks, which is good. But as many of us already know, that's not a guarantee to stop COVID-19.
Right, right. And we have not, as you point out, we have not seen the downtick, the downward trend that we have in other parts of Canada, has not happened in the United States yet.
Exactly. We in Ontario like to point out the fact that, hey, we're under 200 cases, but you know, you've got some provinces that have zero reported cases. And then you've got a place like China, who knows if their numbers are accurate or not, who had reporting zero for, 2 months, then all of a sudden they had the spike in cases.
That's right.
I kind of question the reporting there, but, you know, the U.S. is a very easy example. They're kind of proud when they're under 1,000 deaths for a day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Come on. It's two different realities. That said, we talked about domestic travel. I think right now we're starting to see a lot of sales on hotels and some travel opportunities, which have fully refundable policies. So I think a smart traveler right now can take advantage of these promotions, knowing that there's a good chance it'll get canceled or refunded, but that's okay because you've anticipated that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens, and hopefully people start moving around again, but I think carefully. Carefully
exactly
moving around. Thanks so much for being here, Barry. Appreciate it. That's Barry Trois. He's a travel and financial expert on when and how we move around. When we come back, low-risk drinking, what does it mean? There's a move afoot to perhaps change the guidelines on what is safe and what is not for the amount of alcohol women and men should consume on a weekly basis. Stay with us. I'm Graham Richardson in for Leslie Roberts on Ottawa at Work.
This is Ottawa at Work on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Graham Richardson. We're here for another few moments before the 12 o'clock news. I'm in for Leslie Roberts today, Ottawa at Work. How much do you drink during a week? Do you know what the maximum amount you should drink? What are the guidelines for the amount of alcohol a man or a woman should consume during a week? Not exceed this amount. There is growing evidence that our lower levels of alcohol consumption or low limits on alcohol consumption are not low enough, that we're drinking too much. More importantly, that our medical advice from the Centers for Addiction and Research and from doctors in general, are too generous in terms of the amount of alcohol that it's safe to drink, that is safe to drink for Canadians on a weekly basis. Joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Mitch Shulman. Dr. Shulman, what are we saying here that the recommended, there's evidence that the recommended maximum drinking amount is too much in Canada?
Yep.
And are you surprised by that?
Not at all. And unfortunately, it comes at the worst possible time because people are drinking more because of all the, we'll call it politely, stress associated with what we're going through right now. Look, Canada's guidelines go back to 2012. And those guidelines say that a woman shouldn't drink more than 10 drinks a week and a guy 15 drinks a week.
Right.
Now, it's already more than is recommended in many countries. France, surprisingly enough, the U.S., the U.K. And there's a beautiful study a year or so ago out of The Lancet that looked at it and basically said, if you look at all the cancers in the world, cancers are probably predominantly, to a large degree, a lot of them alcohol-based or alcohol-enhanced or alcohol-worsened. And so that article basically concluded that there is no safe limit for alcohol, and actually we should aim to drink none, which came as a bit of a surprise because look at all the literature over the years, you know, that glass of red wine is supposed to protect your heart. What they did was they compared that benefit against the risk of cancer, breast, colon, and others, and found that the risk of cancer far outweighed the potential benefit heart-wise.
I'll never forget that 60 Minutes report many years ago, right? I believe it was Morley Safer talking about France versus the United States and what was the key to low heart disease, red wine consumption.
Yeah, the French paradox.
Right.
But the reality is, and this comes now out of a study out of British Columbia, the Journal for the Studies of Alcohol and Drugs basically looked in BC the number of cancers, and they looked at the amount of drinking people were doing. And they basically found that a good percentage, 50% or more of the cancers that they were looking at were people who were still drinking within the quote-unquote Canadian limits, the 10 for a woman and the 15 for a guy. And so their conclusion was, you know what? Maybe these limits are too high. Maybe we should follow the rest of the world. Maybe we should be reducing these limits. And considering that these guidelines are from 2012, and we're a little bit further along right now, it might be time to reconsider. And I know it's tough, given the stresses people are surviving through right now. Alcohol, along with other things, is an outlet for a lot of people. But the reality is, drinking any amount probably does increase your risk of all sorts of things, not just inflammation of the pancreas, pancreatitis, not just inflammation of the liver, cirrhosis, not just all these other things, silly behavior, we won't go into it,
sure.
but also these cancers. And so it's time to rethink and probably to bring down what we think is a safe amount of alcohol that people could be consuming.
So the messaging should change to best is zero, but not 15 for a man for a week. What's more ideal in line with the other countries?
Most countries now say the equivalent of about one drink for 5 days or one and a half drinks for 5 days for a guy and one drink per day for 5 days for a woman. So you're talking about three quarters of what we're now recommending effectively.
Yeah.
And that's a reasonable amount. I mean, to be honest with you, if you want to have your glass of red wine with supper, absolutely no problem. And if you limit it to a glass each, You know, when you're having supper occasionally, that shouldn't be a problem. But we do know alcohol, not just for pregnant women, alcohol for everyone is not the be-all and end-all and carries with it some significant risks.
I've noticed in the last 10 to 15 years the commodification, the like alcohol has become more prevalent, it seems.
Yeah.
Whether it's in the wine culture, you know, the tasting rooms, the scotch tours, the beer, the craft brewery industry that's exploded around smaller towns, big towns, all of which, by the way, I have enjoyed. And I'm not not on my high horse here. I've enjoyed.
No, no.
But
I'm saying,
you know, I understand.
As long as you're doing it occasionally.
Yeah.
As long as you're enjoying it occasionally. I think you can't throw out the baby with the bathwater here.
Right.
There's too much going on in our world. And if you want to enjoy an occasional beer, a glass of red wine or white wine, there shouldn't be a problem with that. But just as we tell women, no alcohol is a safe amount, we have to understand that if you're drinking, you do it, I'll say, responsibly. That means different things to different people.
Yes.
And that you're aware of the fact that it's not necessarily good for you, and so you limit, and you're careful with how much you drink, and that's reasonable.
Yeah, that is reasonable. That is reasonable. And it is everything in moderation. And
unfortunately.
Yes, yes. But you know, I've taken a lot of, I've done a little bit of reading on this about, you know, recovered alcoholics and how the struggle afterwards to they have to get new friends because we've built our social lives around instances where alcohol is being served, whether it's meeting at the bar, whether it's going out for a drink after after hockey. All of those things are connected, and maybe it's time to think about that, you know. And this new research suggests that all of that social aspect, you don't have to have alcohol to do it, even though you might enjoy it. And as long as, as you say, as long as it's in moderation, don't worry about it. But our messaging has to be adjusted somewhat.
Exactly. And look, I play in a beer league too.
Sure.
We have beer after the game. I understand completely. But I think you hit the nail right on the head. I think we have to change our thinking about it. Especially in light of the new information. Look, all this stuff has only come out within the last year or so. So we have to slowly adjust, and people will. People are, by and large, really kind of wise, and they understand. And as long as they're doing it with that in mind, as long as they understand how we've evolved in terms of our understanding, as long as they understand we've learned more, the same way that women no longer look at drinking alcohol while they're pregnant and they accept that as a new norm, I'm sure we can evolve to accept a slightly modified norm, whether it's relaxing after a hard day at work or getting together after the game for a couple of beer with the guys. There's other things we can do.
Dr. Mitch Shulman, appreciate this. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. I'm Graham Richardson. That is Ottawa at Work. We're going to break for the news at 12 o'clock. Have a great afternoon, everyone. I'm back with Patricia Bowl at 6 o'clock on CTV News.